Thanks for listening. This is Heidi McCumber. I felt like reading some Drucker today, so I'm reading some Peter F. Drucker from The Practice of Management. I'm on Chapter 2, The Jobs of Management. So here we go. This is a word-for-word reading. Despite its crucial importance, its high visibility, and its spectacular rise, management is the least known and the least understood of our basic institutions. Even the people in a business often do not know what their management does and what it is supposed to be doing, how it acts and why, whether it does a good job or not. Indeed, the typical picture of what goes on in the front office or on the 14th floor in the minds of otherwise sane, well-informed, and intelligent employees, including often people themselves in responsible, managerial, and specialist positions, bears striking resemblance to the medieval geographer's picture of Africa as the stamping ground of the one-eyed ogre, the two-headed pygmy, the immortal phoenix, and the elusive unicorn. What then is management? What does it do? There are two popular answers. One is that management is the people at the top, the term management being little more than euphemism for the boss. The other one defines a manager as someone who directs the work of others and who, as a slogan puts it, does his work by getting other people to do theirs. But these are, at best, merely efforts to tell us who belongs in management. As we shall see, they don't even tell us that. They do not attempt to tell us what management is and what it does. These questions can only be answered by analyzing management's function. For management is an organ, and organs can be described and defined only through their function. Management is the specific organ of the business enterprise. Whenever we talk of a business enterprise, say the United States Steel Company or the British Coal Board, as deciding to build a new plant, laying off workers, or treating its customers fairly, we actually talk of a management decision, a management action, a management behavior. The enterprise can decide, act, and behave only as its managers do. By itself, the enterprise has no effective existence. And conversely, any business enterprise, no matter what its legal structure, must have a management to be alive and functioning. In this respect, there is no difference between private enterprise, the nationalized industries of Great Britain, such old established government monopolies as the post office, and the ministries and trusts of communist Russia. That management is the specific organ of the business enterprise is so obvious that it tends to be taken for granted. But it sets management apart from all other governing organs of all other institutions. The government, the army, or the church, in fact, any major institution, has to have an organ which, in some of its function, is not unlike the management of the business enterprise. But management, as such, is the management of a business enterprise. And the reason for the existence of a business enterprise is that it supplies economic goods and services. To be sure, the business enterprise must discharge its economic responsibility so as to strengthen society in accordance with society's political and ethical beliefs. But these are, to use the logician's term, accidental conditions limiting, modifying, encouraging, or retarding the economic activities of the business enterprise. The essence of business enterprise, the vital principle that determines its nature, is economic performance. The first function, economic performance. Management must always, in every decision and action, put economic performance first. It can only justify its existence and its authority by the economic results it produces. There may be great non-economic results, the happiness of the members of the enterprise, the contribution to the welfare or culture of the community, etc. Yet, management has failed if it fails to produce economic results. It has failed if it does not supply goods and services desired by the consumer at a price the consumer is willing to pay. It has failed if it does not improve, or at least maintain, the wealth-producing capacity of the economic resources entrusted to it. In this, management is unique. A general staff will ask itself, quite legitimately, whether its basic military decisions are compatible with the economic structure and welfare of the country. But it would be greatly remiss in its duty were it to start its military deliberations with the needs of the economy. The economic consequences of military decisions are a secondary, a limiting factor in these decisions, not their starting point or their rationale. A general staff, being the specific organ of a military organization, must, by necessity, put military security first. To act differently would be a betrayal of its responsibility and dangerous malpractice. Similarly, management, while always taking into consideration the impact of its decisions on society, both within and without the enterprise, must always put economic performance first. The first definition of management is therefore that it is an economic organ. Indeed, the specifically economic organ of an industrial society. Every act, every decision, every deliberation of management has as its first dimension an economic dimension. Management's first job is managing a business. This apparently obvious statement leads to conclusions that are far from being obvious or generally accepted. It implies both severe limitations on the scope of management and manager, and a major responsibility for creative action. It means, in the first place, that the skills, the competence, the experience of management cannot, as such, be transferred and applied to the organization and running of other institutions. In particular, a man's success in management carries by itself no promise, let alone a guarantee, of his being successful in government. A career in management is, by itself, not a preparation for a major political office or for leadership in the armed forces, the church, or a university. The skills, the competence, and the experience that are common and therefore transferable are analytical and administrative, extremely important, but secondary to the attainment of the primary objectives of the various non-business institutions. Whether Franklin D. Roosevelt was a great president or a national disaster has been argued hotly in this country for 20 years. But the patent fact that he was an extremely poor administrator seldom enters the discussion. Even his staunchest enemies would consider it irrelevant. What is at issue are his basic political decisions, and no one would claim that these should be determined by the supply of goods and services desired by the consumer at the price the consumer is willing to pay, or by the maintenance or improvement of wealth-producing resources. What to the manager must be the main focus is to the politician of necessity, only one factor among many. A second negative conclusion is that management can never be an exact science. True, the work of a manager can be systematically analyzed and classified. There are, in other words, distinct professional features and a scientific aspect to management. Nor is managing a business just a matter of hunch or native ability. Its elements and requirements can be analyzed, can be organized systematically, can be learned by anyone with a normal human endowment. Altogether, this entire book is based on the proposition that the days of the intuitive managers are numbered. This book assumes that the manager can improve his performance in all areas of management, including the managing of a business, through the systematic study of principles, the acquisition of organized knowledge, and the systematic analysis of his own performance in all areas of his work and job, and on all levels of management. Indeed, nothing else can contribute so much to his skill, his effectiveness, and his performance. And underlying this theme is the conviction that the impact of the manager on modern society and its citizens is so great as to require of him the self-discipline and the high standards of public service of a true professional. And yet, the ultimate test of management is business performance. Achievement, rather than knowledge, remains, of necessity, both proof and aim. Management, in other words, is a practice rather than a science or a profession, though containing elements of both. No greater damage could be done to our economy or to our society than to attempt to professionalize management by licensing managers, for instance, or by limiting access to management to people with a specific academic degree. On the contrary, it is the test of good management that it enables the successful business performer to do his work, whether he be otherwise a good manager or a poor one. And any serious attempt to make management scientific or a profession is bound to lead to the attempt to eliminate those disturbing nuisances, the unpredictabilities of business life, its risks, its ups and downs, its wasteful competition, the irrational choices of the consumer, and, in the process, the economy's freedom and its ability to grow. It is not entirely accident that some of the early pioneers of scientific management ended up by demanding complete cartelization of the economy. Henry Gantt was the prime example, that the one direct outgrowth of American scientific management abroad, the German rationalization movement of the 20s, attempted to make the world safe for professional management by cartelizing it, and that, in our own country, men who were steeped in scientific management played a big part in the attempted nationwide super cartel of the National Recovery Act in the first year of Roosevelt's New Deal. The scope and extent of management's authority and responsibility are severely limited. It is true that in order to discharge its business responsibility, management must exercise substantial social and governing authority within the enterprise, authority over citizens in their capacity as members of the enterprise. It is also a fact that, because of the importance of the business enterprise, management inevitably becomes one of the leading groups in its industrial society. Since management's responsibility is always founded in economic performance, however, it has no authority except as is necessary to discharge its economic responsibility. To assert authority for management over the citizen and his affairs beyond that growing out of management's responsibility for business performance is usurpation of authority. Furthermore, management can only be one leading group among several. In its own self-interest, it can never and must never be the leading group. It has partial rather than comprehensive social responsibility, hence partial rather than comprehensive social authority. Should management claim to be the leading group, or even to be the most powerful of leading groups, it will either be rebuffed and, in the process, be shorn of most of the authority it can claim legitimately, or it will help into power a dictatorship that will deprive management, as well as all other groups in a free society, of their authority and standing. But while the fact that management is an organ of the business enterprise limits its scope and potential, it also embodies a major responsibility for creative action. For management has to manage, and managing is not just passive, adaptive behavior. It means taking action to make the desired results come to pass. The early economists conceived of the businessman and his behavior as purely passive. Success in business meant rapid and intelligent adaptation to events occurring outside, in an economy shaped by impersonal, objective forces that were neither controlled by the businessman nor influenced by his reaction to them. We may call this the concept of the trader. Even if he was not considered a parasite, his contributions were seen as purely mechanical, the shifting of resources to more productive use. Today's economist sees the businessman as choosing rationally between alternatives of action. This is no longer a mechanical concept. Obviously, what choice the businessman makes has a real impact on the economy. But still, the economist's businessman, the picture that underlies the prevailing economic theory of the firm and the theorem of the maximization of profits, reacts to economic developments. He is still passive, still adaptive, though with a choice between various ways to adapt. Basically, this is a concept of the investor or the financier rather than of the manager. Of course, it is always important to adapt to economic changes rapidly, intelligently, and rationally. But managing goes way beyond passive reaction and adaptation. It implies responsibility for attempting to shape the economic environment, for planning, initiating, and carrying through changes in the economic environment, for constantly pushing back the limitations of economic circumstances on the enterprise's freedom of action. What is possible? The economist's economic conditions is therefore only one pole in managing a business. What is desirable in the interest of the enterprise is the other. And while man can never really master his environment, while he is always held within a tight vise of possibilities, it is management's specific job to make what is desirable first possible and then actual. Management is not just a creature of the economy. It is a creator as well, and only to the extent to which it masters the economic circumstances and alters them by conscious, directed action, does it really manage. To manage a business means, therefore, to manage by objectives. Throughout this book, this will be a keynote. Managing managers. To obtain economic performance, there must be an enterprise. Management's second function is therefore to make a productive enterprise out of human and material resources. Concretely, this is the function of managing managers. Enterprise, by definition, must be capable of producing more or better than all the resources that comprise it. It must be a genuine whole, greater than, or at least different from, the sum of its parts, with its output larger than the sum of all inputs. The enterprise cannot therefore be a mechanical assemblage of resources. To make an enterprise out of resources, it is not enough to put them together in logical order and then to throw the switch of capital, as the 19th century economists firmly believed, and as many of their successors among academic economists still believe. What is needed is a transmutation of the resources, and this cannot come from an inanimate resource such as capital. It requires management. But it is also clear that the resources capable of enlargement can only be human resources. All other resources stand under the laws of mechanics. They can be better utilized or worse utilized, but they can never have an output greater than the sum of the inputs. On the contrary, the problem in putting non-human resources together is always to keep to a minimum the inevitable output shrinkage through friction, etc. Man alone, of all the resources available to man, can grow and develop. Only what a great medieval political writer, Sir John Fortescue, called the intentio populi, the directed, focused, united effort of free human beings, can produce a real whole. Indeed, to make the whole that is greater than the sum of its parts has since Plato's days been the definition of the good society. When we speak of growth and development, we imply that the human being himself determines what he contributes. Yet, we habitually define the rank and file worker as distinguished from the manager, as a man who does as he is directed, without responsibility or share in the decisions concerning his work or that of others. This indicates that we consider the rank and file worker in the same light as other material resources, and as far as his contribution to the enterprise is concerned, as standing under the laws of mechanics. This is a serious misunderstanding. The misunderstanding, however, is not in the definition of rank and file work, but rather in the failure to see that many rank and file jobs are in effect managerial, or would be more productive if made so. It does not, in other words, affect the argument that it is managing managers that makes an enterprise. That this is true is shown in the terms we use to describe the various activities needed to build a functioning and productive enterprise. We speak of organization, the formal structure of the enterprise. But what we mean is the organization of managers and of their functions. Neither brick and mortar nor rank and file workers have any place in the organization structure. We speak of leadership and of the spirit of a company. But leadership is given by managers and effective primarily within management. And the spirit is made by the spirit within the management group. We talk of objectives for the company and of its performance. But the objectives are goals for management people. The performance is management performance. And if an enterprise fails to perform, we rightly hire not different workers, but a new president. Managers are also the costliest resource of the enterprise. In big companies, one hears again and again that a good engineer or accountant with 10 or 12 years of working experience represents a direct investment of $50,000 over and above the contribution he has made so far to the company's success. The figure is, of course, pure guess. The margin of error may well be no greater than that in the accountant's meticulous and detailed calculation of the investment in and profitability of a piece of machinery or a plant. But even if the actual figure were only a fraction, it would be high enough to make certain that the investment in managers, though, of course, never shown on the books, outweighs the investment in every other resource in practically all businesses. To utilize this investment as fully as possible is therefore a major requirement of managing a business. To manage managers is therefore to make resources productive by making an enterprise out of them. And management is so complex and multifaceted a thing, even in a very small business, that managing managers is inevitably not only a vital, but a complex job. Managing worker and work. The final function of management is to manage workers and work. Work has to be performed, and the resource to perform it with its workers, ranging from totally unskilled to artists, from wheelbarrow pushers to executive vice presidents. This implies organization of the work so as to make it most suitable for human beings, and organization of people so as to make them work most productively and effectively. It implies consideration of the human being as a resource, that is, as something having peculiar physiological properties, abilities, and limitations that require the same amount of engineering attention as the properties of any other resource, e.g., copper. It implies also consideration of the human resource as human beings having, unlike any other resource, personality, citizenship, control over whether they work, how much and how well, and thus requiring motivation, participation, satisfactions, incentives, and rewards, leadership, status, and function. And it is management and management alone that can satisfy these requirements. For they must be satisfied through work and job and within the enterprise, and management is the activating organ of the enterprise. There is one more major factor in every management problem. Every decision, every action, not, properly speaking, a fourth function of management, but an additional dimension, time. Management always has to consider both the present and the long-range future. A management problem is not solved if immediate profits are purchased by endangering the long-range profitability, perhaps even the survival of the company. A management decision is irresponsible if it risks disaster this year for the sake of a grandiose future. The all-too-common case of the management that produces great economic results as long as it runs the company, but leaves behind nothing but a burned-out and rapidly sinking hulk is an example of irresponsible managerial action through failure to balance present and future. The immediate economic results are actually fictitious and are achieved by paying out capital. In every case where present and future are not both satisfied, where their requirements are not harmonized or at least balanced, capital that is wealth-producing resources is endangered, damaged, or destroyed. The time dimension is inherent in management because management is concerned with decisions for action, and action is always aimed at results in the future. Anybody whose responsibility it is to act rather than just to know operates into the future. But there are two reasons why the time dimension is of particular importance in management's job and of particular difficulty. In the first place, it is the essence of economic and technological progress that the time span for the fruition and proving out of a decision is steadily lengthening. Edison, 50 years ago, needed 2 years or so between the start of laboratory work on an idea and the start of pilot plant operations. Today, it may well take Edison's successors 15 years. A half century ago, a new plant was expected to pay for itself in 2 or 3 years. Today, with capital investment per worker 10 times that of 1900, the payoff period in the same industry is 10 or 12 years. The human organization, such as a sales force or a management group, may take even longer to build and to pay for itself. The second peculiar characteristic of the time dimension is that management, almost alone, has to live always in both present and future. A military leader, too, knows both times, but rarely does he have to live in both at the same time. During peace, he knows no present. All the present is a preparation for the future of war. During war, he knows only the most short-lived future. He is concerned with winning the war at hand, to the practical exclusion of everything else. But management must keep the enterprise successful and profitable in the present, or else there will be no enterprise left to enjoy the future. It must simultaneously make the enterprise capable of growing and prospering, or at least of surviving in the future. Otherwise, it has fallen down on its responsibility of keeping resources productive and unimpaired, has destroyed capital. The only parallel to this time squeeze is the dilemma of the politician between the responsibility for the common good and the need to be reelected as a prerequisite to making his contribution to the common good. But the cynical politician can argue that promises to the voters and performance once in office need not resemble each other too closely. The manager's action on present results, however, directly determines future results. His action on future results, research expenditures, for instance, or plant investment, profoundly influences visible present results. The integrated nature of management. The three jobs of management, managing a business, managing managers, and managing worker and work, can be analyzed separately, studied separately, appraised separately. In each, a present and a future dimension can be distinguished. But in its daily work, management cannot separate them, nor can it separate decisions on present from decisions on future. Any management decision always affects all three jobs and must take all three into account. And the most vital decisions on the future are often made as decisions on the present, on present research budgets or on the handling of a grievance, on promoting this man and letting that one go, on maintenance standards or on customer service. It cannot even be said that one job predominates or requires the greater skill or competence. True, business performance comes first. It is the aim of the enterprise and the reason for its existence. But if there is no functioning enterprise, there will be no business performance, no matter how good management may be in managing the business. The same holds true if worker and work are mismanaged. Economic performance that is being achieved by mismanaging managers is illusory and actually destructive of capital. Economic performance that is being achieved by mismanaging work and worker is equally an illusion. It will not only raise costs to the point where the enterprise ceases to be competitive, it will, by creating class hatred and class warfare, and by making it impossible for the enterprise to operate at all. Managing a business has primacy because the enterprise is an economic institution, but managing managers and managing workers and work have primacy precisely because society is not an economic institution and is therefore vitally interested in these two areas of management in which basic social beliefs and aims are being realized. In this book, we shall always bring together both present and future, but we shall discuss separately each of the three major jobs of management: managing a business, managing managers, managing work and worker. We must, however, never allow ourselves to forget that in actual practice, managers always discharge these three jobs in every one action. We must not allow ourselves to forget that it is actually the specific situation of the manager to have not one but three jobs at the same time, discharged by and through the same people, exercised in and through the same decision. Indeed, we can only answer our question, what is management and what does it do, by saying that it is a multi-purpose organ that manages a business and manages managers and manages worker and work. If one of these were omitted, we would not have management anymore, and we also would not have a business enterprise or an industrial society. That completes the end of chapter 2. And if you're listening this far, I have a question for you. What do you think about the section on managing worker and work? Drucker writes, it implies also consideration of the human resource as human beings having, unlike any other resource, personality, citizenship, control over whether they work, how much and how well, and thus requiring motivation, participation, satisfactions, incentives and rewards, leadership, status and function. And it is management and management alone that can satisfy these requirements, for they must be satisfied through work and job and within the enterprise. What is your thought, or what do you think about this particular statement and Net Promoter Score? It's my theory that how workers feel about the organization they work for is directly related to the Net Promoter Score of the company to its customers. I'll leave you on that thought. Hope you enjoyed reading.